Nicholas von Amsdorf was the only nobleman in Luther's inner circle, yet few people today have ever heard of him. Learn more about one of the first evangelical bishops in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, Nicholas von Amsdorf, champion of Martin Luther's Reformation. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 and request the Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Nicholas von Amsdorf. In John's Gospel, the account of the resurrection is peculiar. The actual resurrection is not recorded. It is simply a burial, and then, next thing you know, the women are there and the tomb is empty. The disciples are there and the tomb is empty. The angels are there. The tomb is empty, and then Jesus appears, not only to Mary, but then later to his disciples minus Thomas, and then to his disciples plus Thomas. And everyone is seeing things. They're seeing the linen cloth. They're seeing the angels. They're seeing an empty tomb. Mary is seeing Jesus, and Thomas is seeing Jesus. And all of this is written so that we who have not seen might also believe. We haven't seen for ourselves, but through the word of those who have, we believe. Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. on this Easter Tuesday. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about the resurrection according to John's Gospel. Joining us to do so, Dr. Bill Weinrich, professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and author of the Concordia Commentary on John chapters 1 through 7. Dr. Weinrich, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's always good to be with you.
What's unique about John's account of the resurrection?
Well, it's a good question, and I would ask your listeners just to read the fourfold gospel accounts and see how very different John is from them. He has totally unique aspects to it. He has this interesting race between Peter and the beloved disciple to the grave. He has this remarkable little talk with Mary Magdalena. The remarkable words that he is ascending to my Father and your Father, as we will no doubt talk about a little later, a very unique appearance to the apostles in the upper room. And then, of course, the famous Thomas episode, which is often referred to as that of Doubting Thomas. But I'd like to give your listeners perhaps an alternative view on that.
So let's talk about the event of the resurrection, which is not recorded, the before and the after. And John seems to want to focus on this vacant tomb that the women and then later Peter and John find. Why is that?
Well, it's a very good question. And I think what John fundamentally is wishing to say is that the empty tomb is not perhaps the place where you wish to look. Of course, you do have the clothes which are folded and so forth, but I think even more important is this little phrase that Mary turns and sees Jesus. In other words, she sees Jesus as she is looking away from that empty tomb. And I'm going to suggest that that prepares us, actually, for Jesus' appearance to his disciples later on, so that the empty tomb does kind of function as a sign. The beloved disciples peers in. He sees the clothes, which are neatly folded. And then we have a very Johannine statement, no doubt. He saw and he believed. So there's no doubt that the empty tomb functions as a sign that he is not there, that he is risen. But the more important question, at least narratively and thematically, is where actually is the resurrected Jesus to be seen and known?
I also notice here that where the other gospel writers who record the event have angels announcing in an explicit way, Jesus, who was crucified, he is not here. He has risen to one degree or another. They say something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The angels are left out of John's account, and it seems as though, and am I wrong here, it's Christ there to announce his own resurrection.
Well, actually, that's a very good observation. Now, the angels are there. There's two of them. And one is seated at the head of where Jesus lay and the other at the foot. But they simply ask Mary, why are you weeping? And from that point on, of course, the angels really have no role. You're absolutely right in that. And at this point, Mary turns and sees Jesus, but does not recognize him. And this is a crucial aspect of, I think, what John wants to say, although it's similar in other Gospels too, for example, Luke 24. But it does prepare, again, the important question, where, in fact, do you see and recognize Jesus? And Jesus then, when Mary asks, thinking he is the gardener, and of course here we have paradisial images coming in, perhaps royal burial scenes, because it was characteristic of the ancient Jews to bury their kings in garden tombs. So you have a number of themes kind of subliminally there. But Jesus then asks a crucial question of Mary, whom do you seek? And this question echoes what in this gospel is in fact the first words of Jesus. And that is all the way back to John 1, where the two disciples have heard John the Baptist say, "Behold the Lamb of God," and they follow Jesus. And we are told Jesus turns around and, seeing them following him, says to them, "What are you seeking?" Some manuscripts actually have there, "Whom are you seeking?" I'm not sure it makes a whole lot of difference. But what we have is the whole gospel is, at least up to this point, kind of bookended by that question from Jesus, "Whom are you seeking?" And in a way, it is a thematic question for anyone who reads this gospel. What are you seeking as you read the account of Jesus's life, death, and resurrection? And the implicit answer, which hopefully is given, is, "I seek the Master whom I am to follow." But we shouldn't overlook these little comments that can easily be seen as almost virtually throw-offs, but that statement, "Whom are you seeking?" And now as we go forward, we will want to answer the question, not only whom do you seek, but where should you seek it?
I notice here, just kind of flagging some of the verbs in the account that we're talking about here at the beginning of chapter 20. Mary goes to the tomb while it's still dark. She sees that the stone has been taken away. Then she goes to tell the disciples. She doesn't know what's happening, but Peter arrives first. He looks and he sees those cloths you mentioned before. He sees the cloths again. And then John arrives. He goes in, or he does not go in. He sees and he believes. Mary's looking in the tomb. She sees the angels. Then she turns around and sees Jesus. Does that all culminate with her saying, ultimately, kind of the announcement of the resurrection itself formally, "I have seen the Lord"?
Well, I think it does. And if you just keep in mind how freighted throughout John's gospel the language of sight is, the disciples later on will say to Thomas, "We have seen the Lord." What is kind of striking, though, with the Magdalena passage is kind of nothing follows on it. In fact, there is a shift, as it were, of scenery straightway to the upper room. I'm just going to read verses, 18 of chapter 20. "Mary Magdalena went and said to the disciples, 'I have seen the Lord,' and she told him the things which he had said to her." And then there's a quick change of scenery. Now, I'd like to suggest that kind of incompleteness kind of leaves the reader, or at least this reader, somewhat unsatisfied because there's kind of no response to that witness, except the next scene. But I would like just to point out, if I might, Todd, to go back a little earlier to chapter 20, there are, throughout that first scene with the stone rolled away and the clothes folded and so forth, there are clear echoes from the Lazarus story and Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. But there are similarities, there are kind of nuances, intimations, but complete differences. So, for example, in the Lazarus story, that's in John chapter 11, Jesus asked for the stone to be rolled away. Here it is already rolled away. There he says to Lazarus, come out. Here Jesus is clearly already out. In chapter 11, the person of Lazarus is still bound by the burial clothes. The sunedrion, the head wrapping, is still said to be around his head. Here, that head covering is neatly folded and set aside in one place. So these are just ways of saying that resurrection account of Lazarus was an intimation of the resurrection which Jesus himself would become. You may remember it is in chapter 11 where Jesus actually says to Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me shall not die. So there is already this little tie-in with Lazarus. And I'd like to remind your listeners that the Lazarus story is not simply a story of a physical resurrection as a sign of who Jesus is. It is also a conversion story, where Lazarus is coming out of the tomb, the place of death. And within the thematics of this gospel, that is a coming out of the place of death, which is the place of the law. And it is only when one comes out and becomes a follower of Jesus that one moves from death to life. Something like that happens with Mary Magdalene as well. She looks into the tomb, she's bending, looking into the tomb, and then turns and faces Jesus. And so I have a hunch that Mary here too has now, in seeing the resurrected Jesus, become, as it were, a true disciple.
Let's rewind a little bit to those words that you had mentioned before from John himself, where Peter arrives, looks in, but doesn't go in. John arrives and goes in and sees these things. And it's said of John, he saw and believed. And then John himself comments a little bit on what their state of mind was at the time. Talk about that encounter where John is said to believe.
Yeah, I actually think this little interaction about Peter and John is one of the more perhaps difficult things to actually get right in this passage. Peter and John are always paired in this gospel, so it's an important little relationship they have. We are told that John runs ahead but did not go into the tomb. Peter runs ahead, goes on in for whatever reason, and we are told he saw the linen clothes lying there and the napkin which had been on the head, not lined with the linen clothes, but rolled up neatly, the verb would suggest, and all by itself. Then that other disciple, John, reaches the tomb, goes in, sees and believes. Now, what did he see? And I think from the context, it suggests that he saw that napkin that had been around Jesus' head now neatly folded up and put to a side. That, again, kind of recalls to our minds, again, the Lazarus story, where that same word is used about the head cloth, but it is still wound around Lazarus's head. So keep in mind, John the Apostle, called never by name in this gospel, but the disciple whom Jesus loved, is throughout this gospel kind of a post-resurrection interpreter. You will remember that the first appearance of the disciple whom Jesus loved comes in John 13, when he lies upon the breast of Jesus. And this is an echo of the last verse of the prologue, John 1:18, where we are told that Jesus is eston kolpon tou patras, is on the breast or the lap of the Father, and that is the posture of the interpreter. He who is in the breast of the Father, who is on the kolpon of the Father, he is the one who has made the Father known. And so John appears as the beloved disciple, but is never quite just one of them. He's the interpreter. He is the one who from time to time breaks in to make sure that we understand this. For example, in John 2 with the cleansing of the temple, Jesus says, if you destroy this temple, I will raise it up in 3 days. And then John, as it were, takes the microphone. This he said about the body which he was going to give over for the life of the world. Or later in John 12, when I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw all to myself. Then John takes the microphone. This he said in order to indicate by what death he was to die. And indeed, from time to time, he makes it clear that at the time of Jesus actually doing these things and saying certain things, the scriptures were not yet fully apprehended about it. Jesus was as yet kind of a strange and puzzling figure, that Jesus is the fulfillment of the scriptures, that he is actually proclaimed in the way the Old Testament proclaims him, was a post-resurrection phenomenon. And in John's gospel, that is the function of the Paraclete Spirit, who is mentioned in chapters 14, 15, and 16. And it's very important to keep in mind that John, the beloved disciple, the author and writer of this fourth gospel, is himself the mouth of the Paraclete. So I think when it says that he saw and believed, it is a way in which this interpreter, John, the Paraclete's mouth, the disciple whom Jesus loved, it is now the first one who sees Jesus and understands that he is risen from the dead, as it was quite apart from later scriptural verification. It might already be a certain preliminary echo, if you will, of what Jesus says to Thomas at the end. Blessed are those who have not seen but yet believe, because what John did not see, of course, at least at this point, was the person of Jesus. That particular benefit would be Mary's.
Mary's theory is grave robbery, it sounds like. She says, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. As far as we can tell, who are they?
Well, it's a good question, and if we were reading Matthew, we would kind of know, wouldn't we? Because it's explicit there that the Jews go to the soldiers that were at the tomb and they bribe them, don't say anything to anybody because the disciples might have come and taken. I'm not sure, frankly, Todd, that the question of who this they is all that important. It, of course, it sets up the scene, doesn't it? You're right. She doesn't know what has happened yet. Her first thought was, we laid him there. He's not there. Who has taken him away? And I might say that John's language is wondrously transparent, but also puzzling at times. And I would suggest to your audience that they should always expect more in John rather than less in John. And I would simply point out here in this first instance where Mary speaks, where she says, I do not know where they have put him. And throughout John's gospel, these little adverbs of where, the interrogative hapu or the spatial adverb pu, where, are kind of markers, frankly, for the crucifixion. And so my hunch is that more is in these little adverbs of place. Where have they placed him? She even asked Jesus, we do not know where they have taken him. That these little spatial markers cast our eyes again forward to that true culmination of the narrative where Jesus appears to the disciples and to Thomas.
Is there anything to be taken from her first account, which seems to indicate that there are other women with her? We do not know where. And then when she encounters Jesus outside the tomb and asks him the question, it is my Lord and it is I don't know.
Yes. There is this change from the plural to the singular, and I frankly am not so sure that much is to be made of it. Some commentators suggest that the initial we reveals that other women were with her, kind of like we see in the synoptic accounts, for example, but that in John's literary method, he focuses upon a single person. That frankly makes perfectly good sense. Where in the second instance, Mary is very much speaking ex persona. So yes, there is that change. And I would just assume that, you know, sometimes we can speak in the plural when in fact it's kind of a general statement of fact. We don't know how many stars there are in the sky. That doesn't mean that I'm along with 15 physicists at the moment or astronomers. It just means a general statement of unknowing or of knowing. And it might be nothing more than that, frankly.
So let's deal with why Jesus, I don't know if he's playing along, or she obviously doesn't recognize him. And at least for the moment, it appears, as in kind of the Emmaus account in Luke's gospel, he doesn't want to be recognized momentarily.
Well, I think that's exactly right. It's not just, however, that he doesn't want to be recognized at the moment. It's that in this particular arena of seeing, he can't any longer be recognized because he is now going to come in a manner which is simply different from his earthly sojourn. So he is, as it were, this side of going to the Father, no longer recognizable. But he will be recognized when he goes to the Father. So we have to remember, and this is, I think, a very crucial point, not just about John's gospel, but all of them, that the resurrection of Jesus is not, as it were, the discrete personal biographical event of one man's life. That would be something like the raising of Jairus's daughter or Lazarus. So the resurrection of Jesus, though, is not simply a discrete event in Jesus' biography. Jesus's resurrection, as it were, opens up the divine purposes of the Father for all the world now to see, to know, to come to. And of course, scholars use the big word eschatological at this point, but it's fair. His resurrection is an eschatological moment in which the presence of Jesus is now quite different because, and I think this is true of John's gospel certainly, because now he will come and be known by way of the church's own ministry and life. And so I think that Jesus stresses, or John stresses, that he is not recognized. You've mentioned Luke 24. It's another good example, the road of Emmaus, that there it's not until the breaking of the bread that they see him and know him. In John's gospel, as we will talk about, I'm sure, later. It's where he comes to the disciples and shows them the marks of his crucifixion. Then they have seen him and they rejoice. So I think the idea that he is not recognizable is not, as some commentators have put it, that she's crying and so the tears are kind of befuddling her sight or something like that, or that it's not yet light and she can't see him quite clearly. That'd be nonsense. The thematic point is that he is now the resurrected one who's coming as the resurrected one, is not as he came to Mary and the other disciples during his earthly sojourn. That's the real point.
Is that also the point of his words to Mary, "Do not continue to cling to me," and so forth?
Absolutely, and it's an important point as well. Jesus says to Mary, and you've translated it right, it's may with a present imperative. It doesn't then mean don't do this, as trying to stop her from doing something. That's not the meaning. It is stop clinging to me or stop holding on to me. The point here is not some sort of general prohibition about touching him. And we might point out that later on with Thomas, Jesus invites such a touching. Place your finger here and your fist there. But it's like somebody who is on his way is going to go on a journey, and you want to hold him back. And you say, stop holding me back. I have a place to go. And so we should take this prohibition of Jesus along with what he then now says. Stop clinging to me, as if to say, I am not for you now any longer as I was for you previously, for I have not yet gone to my Father, and then he adds significantly, to my Father and your Father, go to tell your brothers, that I go to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. And so that Jesus wishes, as it were, to be freed from the clutches of Mary, if I can put it that way, is in fact the very visual way in which this gospel says, the way the earthly Jesus was apprehended, the way he was known, the way he was heard, the way he was touched, is no longer going to be the way that he is apprehended, known, touched, and heard. And again, in my judgment, that is simply to say, the earthly Jesus was one thing, the resurrected Jesus is now an ecclesial figure in a way that earlier he was not.
We're talking about the resurrection according to John's Gospel. Dr. Bill Weinrich of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, is our guest, author of the Concordia Commentary on John chapters 1 through 7. When we come back, we're going to talk about Jesus appearing to the disciples. It's not really two accounts, one minus Thomas, one plus, but one account. We'll find out why after this.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start. The foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Christ alone. It sounds so basic, doesn't it? And yet, how often do we forget? This April, join the Lutheran Witness and turn your eyes to the cross of Christ. Walk with David Scare through St. Matthew's Passion Narrative. Gain new insights into Jesus' physical suffering with Gerard Stanley, Sr., M.D., and meditate on a sacred masterwork with artist Kelly Schumacher. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry, lcms.org/deaconess.
The LCMS Youth Gathering is the Lutheran Federal Credit Union Ministry of the Month. During April, if you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to the LCMS Youth Gathering. Learn more at lutheranfcu.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Good for you, good for the church. lutheranfcu.org.
Your daily Lutheran Bible class. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Are you a high school guy or girl interested in theology and thinking about becoming a pastor or deaconess? Christ Academy High School at Concordia Theological Seminary is the thing for you. Spend 2 weeks worshiping and learning like a seminary student while having fun and building lasting friendships. Join us this summer at Christ Academy from June 16th to the 29th. Visit ctsfw.edu/ca for more info.
My kind of town, Chicago is.
The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference is coming to Chicago for its one and only 2019 conference. You can meet and hear Ross Douthat, Matt Harrison, Wesley Smith, Aaron Wolf, Hans Feeney, and Will Whedon Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the resurrection according to John's Gospel with Dr. Bill Weinrich, professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, where they are offering free tuition for all incoming residential pastoral ministry and deaconess students in the 2018 academic year. Learn more at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Let's talk about Jesus appearing to the disciples. You want to say this is not two accounts, one minus Thomas, one plus Thomas, but actually one account. Why is that?
Well, in a way that the text itself tells us to, we are told quite explicitly that in the first appearance, Thomas was not there. And so the Thomas story is already intimated within the very first account. So let me just, if I might, just go through this first account and tell you what I think to be of great importance here. And I might say to your listeners, a comparison of Jesus' appearance to the disciples in John 20 with Jesus' appearance to the disciples, not the two on the road to Emmaus, but later the disciples, that comparison would be very instructive, because in the Lucan account, it is very evident that the issue is the reality of the resurrection of the man Jesus according to the flesh. And so there in Luke, the disciples are astonished to see him, and he asks them actually to touch him. Why? In order that they might know that he is not a bodiless demon, a nosomaton daimon, that he is not a dacetic spirit or something like that. But then we are told, interestingly, in Luke, having touched him and seen that he's still in the body, they were afraid. This is very different in John's Gospel. Here Jesus comes to the disciples and immediately speaks the eschatological shalom, peace be unto you. Now that is already a liturgical image. This is the coming of the eschatological kingdom, which is free of sin and the stain of the tempter, and the peace of which the prophets had spoken. But then what does he do? When he had said this, and that's the way the gospel associates when he had said this, "Peace be unto you," he showed them his hands and his side. That associates in the closest possible way the peace and the signs of his peace, which is the signs of his crucifixion. And then, unlike in Luke, John says, "And then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord." Now, here we have, I think, Todd, the more important scene, namely when it is associated with the explicit demonstration of the marks of his passion. But the language that the disciples were glad echoes John 8:56. "Abraham saw my day and rejoiced and was glad in it." In other words, this is the day of the Lord, which Abraham had already prophetically foreseen. And if now we go back to that passage where Abraham is said to be glad, we must remember that it was in the context of the Festival of Tabernacles, when the Jews were especially thinking of the so-called binding of Isaac, which was understood to be associated with the Festival of Booths and the Day of the Lord, as well as the Passover. So in this way, again, the whole Isaac typology of the obedient son sacrificed by his father, of course, that's somewhat incomplete in Genesis 22, but in John 3:16, "The Father loved the world in this way that he gave his only son." That's an Isaac claim. And so in many and various ways, the language centers the form and the appearance of the resurrected one as the crucified one. And so it seems to me the real thrust of this appearance to the disciples is to answer this question: how will, in fact, the resurrected Christ come to us? And the answer is, as the crucified one. And that's why then the church's later life, the symbols of the resurrection even, the symbols of the church's reality, all center around the cross. The cross is, you know, you often get this question, what is the true symbol of the resurrection? And my answer is always, well, it's not the empty tomb. It is, in fact, the cross itself. And so all the apostles, certainly Paul, describe themselves in cruciform terms. We speak of the sacraments in cruciform terms, baptized into his death and resurrection. "This is my body given for you. This is my blood shed for you." The apostle, especially in 2 Corinthians, speaks of himself as given over into death. He will say in 1 Corinthians 1, "I preach nothing but Christ the crucified." And the question always arises, how is it that the crucified Jesus is so central and determinative even after the resurrection? And my answer is that the resurrection reveals the content of the cross. The cross is the place of filial obedience. It is the place of the defeat of death. It is the place of the new tree of life. And so in John's gospel, Jesus comes to them in the form of the crucified. And if you look again at that passage in John 20:19 and following, when he had said this, he showed them his hands and side. The disciples were glad when they saw the Lord, and Jesus said to them again, "Peace be unto you." So that little scene of the joy of the disciples at seeing the resurrected in the form of the crucified is bookended before and immediately after by Jesus saying, "Peace be unto you." And then, and certainly importantly, Jesus breathes on them and then says, as the Father has sent me, in that very same way do I now send you. And of course, the sending of Jesus within the narrative scopus of this gospel is in fact his baptism. And so this is in a way kind of a baptismal text. In a way, I have no problem with saying that it's a kind of ordination text. Whosoever sins you retain, they are retained. Those who are forgiven, they are forgiven. He breathes on them, the same language used with the creation of Adam. So there's kind of perhaps various layers of meaning at this point. But important as well, I would argue, is John 19:30, where we are told that Jesus says, "Tetelestai, it is finished," and bending his head down, "Paredokon ta pneuma," he handed over the Spirit. Now, I know it's very, very common for people to think that that just means he died, and there's no doubt that that's the meaning that is also there. But the use of this phraseology that he handed over the Spirit at the moment of his death is so unusual. It's unique. In all of Greek literature, it's a totally unique phraseology. And I am convinced, and I'm happy to say many others are as well, that this is most especially a reference to his handing over the Holy Spirit. And while it is true that there's a little bit of a difficulty in uniting and identifying 19:30 with this bestowal of the Spirit in chapter 20, I do think that in the previous passage there is kind of, as it were, a kind of a narrative pause, as it were. Jesus handed over the Spirit, and now we kind of have to wait for the implicit meaning of that. That the true Pentecost comes at the formation of a community of apostolic belief in which the ongoing ministry of the earthly Jesus now continues such as it was in the power of his resurrection and through the instrumentality of his Spirit. So I would argue as well that receive the Holy Spirit, which is chapter 20, verse 22, and John 19:30 should be interpreted together.
And how does this tie in then with his next appearance 8 days for Thomas's benefit?
Yes. Well, as you are well aware, Thomas always has a bad rap. I mean, it's doubting Thomas. He is one who has to see before he believes, and Jesus rebukes him later, and that kind of idea. I have frankly come to doubt the doubting Thomas theme, and sometimes intrigue or annoy my students by saying, I think Thomas got it right. Keep in mind, again, how the Gospel of John actually speaks of the crucifixion of Jesus, the cross of Jesus. The cross of Jesus is said to be his exaltation. That is the technical language of ascension. And so in John's gospel, the ascension of Christ is located in his crucifixion. Similarly, and we don't have time, I'm sure, to go into all these passages, but I'd ask your readers just to take a look at the dense thematics of John 12:32. When I am lifted up, ectes geis, out of the earth, right? That corresponds to the parable earlier in John 12 where he says, unless the seed of wheat, that is Jesus, falls eistein gain into the earth and die, it does not give forth much fruit. Now, John 12:32, when I am lifted up ectes geis, out of the earth, that's resurrection talk, I shall draw all to myself. That's the missiological outreach of the church by which much fruit will be acquired. Jesus speaks of this in John 14. So John has a way of kind of kaleidoscoping the events, if you will, of the salvific history of Passion Week, if you will, into the cross event itself. Likewise, if I'm right about John 19:30, Pentecost as well. So you have the crucifixion, which is in this gospel in no way seen to be a humiliation. It is the locatedness of his majesty, his ascension, the content of his resurrection, as well as the place and origin of his bestowal of the Spirit. If we keep that whole thematic in mind, when the disciples tell Thomas, "We have seen the Lord," what does Thomas say? He says, "I won't believe unless I can see the marks of his crucifixion." If I could put words into Thomas's mouth that I think he would agree with, I might say something like this. "You say that you have seen him, but I tell you, unless I see with my own eyes the resurrected, the ascended, Spirit-giving Christ, who am I going to believe in? That's the one I believe in." So I think what Thomas is saying, I must have the same vision, O disciples, as you did, because you have been given to see the resurrected Jesus as, in fact, he comes to us, as the one who still bears on his body the trophies of his passion. And unless I see him as well, I'm really not part of your group. I, too, must have this personal, and in this case, tactile relationship with Jesus. So I think in many ways Thomas is not doubting the fact of the resurrection. I don't think that's in the story at all. I think Thomas is a story in which he insists upon the actual grabbing hold of the one who has ascended to the Father. And I might add here that it is, to me at least, interesting that when Jesus says to Mary Magdalene, "Tell the disciples, tell your brothers that I am going to my Father and your Father," as you know, Todd, this is the first and only time that the disciples are indicated as brothers, which is to say they have as their Father the Father of Jesus. "And of course, your God and my God." That already intimates, does it not, the confession of Thomas. "I am going up to your God, my God, and your God." That's what Thomas will say, "my Lord and my God." I think the going up that Jesus is speaking about is often misunderstood to mean that he's going away into heaven, as it were. And here I would simply remind your readers of the book of Acts, which I think in this respect can be quite helpful. The book of Acts begins with the ascension of Jesus and the coming of the Holy Spirit. And then the rest of the story is simply the story of the church. It is the story of councils. It's the story of apostolic journeys, of apostolic preaching, of martyrdom, and the like. In other words, the reality of the ascended Lord has as its content the life of the church. That's how you speak finally of what it means for Jesus to be raised from the dead, is that he has brought about a community of faith in which his voice continues to be heard, his message continues to be believed, his body and blood continue to be proffered, the baptism of his own paschal meaning continues also to be administered. And in a way, I think all of that is within the Thomas demand that unless I grab hold of the crucified, resurrected one, or the resurrected, crucified one, what am I to believe? I will believe that. And when I grab hold of that, I will confess what I grab hold of, in fact, to be my God and my Lord. It's a highly liturgical phraseology, I think, and I think we do this every Sunday morning, frankly, in the Eucharistic liturgy. And if I might just add to this, if my way of seeing this has merit, then Jesus does not rebuke him when Jesus says, "Blessed are those who you have believed because you have seen, blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." here we have to keep in mind that the ancient text had no paragraph indentation. I'm looking at my RSV as I speak, and it has a paragraph indentation with verse 30. I bet your book does too, that you happen to have in front of you. But that hints to our minds that we have something new going on. Nothing new is going on. One must read immediately upon verse 29, immediately continue with verse 30 and verse 31. And when one does that, if I can kind of paraphrase the meaning here again, it kind of goes like this. Thomas says, "My Lord and my God." Jesus says, "Because you have seen, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen, but yet believe. And in order that you might believe, I have written this book, that you might believe that Jesus is in fact the Son of God and the Christ, and in believing you might have life in his name." In other words, the Thomas story leads directly and organically into the purpose statement for the Gospel of John itself. And so we might state the purpose of John like this. I have written this book about Jesus the Christ, the Son of God, in order that although you have not seen as Thomas has, nonetheless, upon reading this book, you will come to know that what Thomas said about this resurrected Jesus, who comes as the Eucharistic crucified Jesus, is in fact your God and Lord. That's the whole reason for my writing.
So, with less than a minute here, Dr. Weinrich, what does John mean when he concludes that these things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, believing you may have life in his name? It sounds like he almost puts those words right into Jesus' mouth, too.
Absolutely. And in a way, the words of the gospel writer are, of course, Jesus' words. As I said earlier, the gospel writer is the mouth of the paraclete. And in John 14, 15, and 16, we are told that the paraclete will recall to your minds all that Jesus said and did. That's what the gospel of John does. And he will lead you into all truth. That's what John does. It's an interpretive text guiding you to understand the Old Testament narrative Christologically in order that you might believe in his name. I happen to believe that's a baptismal phrase. So I think in some respects, John's gospel can be understood as a pre-baptismal catechetical text. If you believe this, namely what Thomas said and the whole story that leads up to Thomas's confession, if Thomas's confession will be your confession upon reading this gospel text, you're ready to be baptized. That's kind of what I think lies behind this gospel text.
You and I have both lost loved ones in the last few years. I'm a mother, you, your wife, Barbara. How can we find comfort in John's account of the resurrection?
Well, Jesus comes, again, as I said, as one showing the signs of his passion. It's a way of kind of also reminding us that the life of resurrection, which we have been graced to live by virtue of our own baptisms, nonetheless is still within a context of struggle and indeed death. And yet, in a kind of strange but nonetheless wholly true fashion, within the struggle of the faithful, within even their own death, there lives the life of the resurrected one. Jesus himself said, we referred to it earlier, speaks to Martha in chapter 11, "I am the resurrection, the life. Whoever believes in me, even though he die, yet shall he live. And indeed, he who believes in me shall never die." Here you have this strange fact that the death of the believer, even though it removes from this earthly life and the particular relationships and joys that that earthly life in fact gives, nonetheless, even in that death and through that death, there is the fact of the resurrected. And here I kind of did not want to say the hope of the resurrection. That's true, of course. But I would like to emphasize the actual present facticity of the resurrection. which in my judgment and in the way I look at things, as I've mentioned in various ways, becomes a sacramental and an ecclesial fact. And so, as I told my father a long time ago, and of course Barbara's in here too, my mother now as well, when I go to that altar and I sing with angels and archangels and with all the hosts of heaven, we laud and magnify thy glorious name, evermore praising thee and saying, in a way, I am joining already with them in a heavenly Eucharistic praise. And at that altar, I don't know how many people might be standing or kneeling at that altar. What I do know is that they're not the only ones there. I also know who else is there. That's kind of how I look at it.
Dr. Bill Weinrich is professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the Concordia Commentary on John chapters 1 through 7. You can have this great resource for your very own, purchase it from Concordia Publishing House by giving them a call weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy under the Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Weinrich, thank you very much. Christ is risen.
Christ is risen indeed. Hallelujah.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll continue our series Introducing the Books of the Bible, talking with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller about 1 Kings, and we'll visit with the author of the Book of the Month, Deaconess Elizabeth Ullman, Demystifying the Proverbs 31 Woman. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.